Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Chertoff from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from Washington is Daniel Kahn. Dan is the acting chief of the fraud section of the Department of Justice. And we're going to be talking today about insights from their evaluation of compliance programs, as well as from recent settlements. Dan, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really my pleasure to be here. I should start, like I always do, by saying that the views that I express are my own and not those of the department, but I'm really looking forward to joining you today and looking forward to the conversation.
Us too, and duly noted. Now, there's been much already discussed about the most recent DOJ guidance on evaluating compliance programs. To your mind, what are the top points compliance teams should take away from the latest iteration?
Sure. So when we revised the compliance guidance earlier this year, the main point of doing so was just to really draw upon lessons that we've learned over the past year, as well as work in some feedback that we received from the business and compliance community. And in some ways, it's a little bit of, I say jokingly, but we are always looking at our internal policies in the same way that we hope that companies are looking at their compliance programs. There's no policy that's beyond revision or enhancement or evolution. And so just because we have a policy doesn't mean we can't make it better. And I think we felt that the evaluation of corporate compliance programs was a very good document to begin with. We thought that it really laid out our approach to evaluating compliance programs and frankly provided guidance for companies to be able to look internally at their own compliance programs. And I think what we made clear in the first version of it was that what we expect from companies is to come in and really explain how they're thinking of compliance. Really, every question in there is geared at trying to get a better understanding of the thought process of companies about why they're making certain compliance decisions, whether it's resources, whether it's where they're devoting their resources, how many resources, whether it's how they're addressing certain control issues, due diligence, M&A, and anything else. It's not so much about what the ultimate decision is. It's more about how they got there. And then on top of that, what we follow that up with is trying to get a sense of the evidence and data that supports that it's working. And so how the company's thinking about it and proof that it's actually working is really what we're driving at with that document. Now, the revisions that we made span a number of issues, but really I think some of the more significant ones are focusing on the finer points but important points. So for example, how the company is using and how the compliance program is using data, whether they have adequate access to data, and that can be really a threshold issue of is the data all on the same platform, for example. Certainly a number of companies are multinational. They grow by acquisition, and a lot of times as companies grow bigger through acquisitions, the various companies that they're acquiring may not be on the same platform. And so if that continues to grow, you suddenly have, 8 different platforms for a multinational company. And so how is the company going to actually be able to synthesize and analyze that data across its various units and subsidiaries? And it ends up being siloed. And that's obviously a problem because then the right hand's not talking to the left. And so that was certainly a key component of the revisions we made, as well as things like, for due diligence, are third parties being looked at just at the beginning of a relationship, or is there periodic updating of the due diligence? Because a third party, for example, that may not start out as risky may evolve into one that's risky. So there were a number of enhancements that we made to the evaluation of compliance program guidance, but certainly by no means is a game changer or substantively altering what we had set out to do or anything else like that.
Well, and certainly, those two areas you singled out, the collecting data and ongoing auditing and monitoring of third parties are issues that really are challenging ones. You know, as you notice, a lot of times companies are on different platforms. It's difficult to collect the data. People aren't sure what data to collect. It is an ongoing issue. And third parties, you know, they tend to, from what I hear over and over again, they're more than willing to be forthright in sharing information at the time of the contract, but afterwards it can get more difficult. And this will certainly provide additional leverage for that. Now, in the evolution of the guidance, are there any areas where you're seeing people getting confused or jumping to the wrong conclusions?
I haven't seen too much of that, no. To some extent, as with any guidance document that you put out, you hope that it is taken in the spirit that it's intended. And this is very much intended, as I described, to really provide the way we're thinking about compliance and the way that companies can think about compliance, but by no means is meant to be a check-the-box exercise. And so anytime you put something out like this, My concern is always that a company will look at it and say, okay, well, I need to do X, Y, Z. And if I do that, I'll have a good compliance program. I think, you know, for example, training and measuring the effectiveness of training, the last thing we want is for a company to focus so much on the testing of how effective the training is that they lose sight of the more important point, which is the training itself. And so you can always get carried away with a guidance document, but I think we hopefully have done a good job in this one of really stressing the purpose of it and that this is not a check the box document. And I think the way that it's framed, how it's done in question format, hopefully lends itself to the proper interpretation.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm hearing people have been fairly clear on it, and particularly in the area of, for example, of risk-based approach to things. Now, let's focus on FCPA. When it comes to FCPA enforcement, there's much reading of tea leaves when it comes to the pace of settlements, with some seeing a slowdown, others arguing no. Is there one, or are there people seeing more than they should?
So I don't think that there has been one, and internally looking at our cases, looking at our case initiations, looking at our investigations, looking at our resolutions, there has not been a slowdown. Certainly when the pandemic started, I think everyone was wondering the effect it was going to have, and there would, I think, inevitably be some slowdown, just trying to figure out how to do things, but it was, I think, much better than we expected in terms of how we've been able to adapt. And by no means do I suggest that it hasn't had an impact. I mean, it has. And I think the most obvious place would be in terms of doing in-person interviews. We're working around that. There's ways to obviously do in-person interviews safely. There's ways to do interviews virtually. And then there may be situations where we want to put off the interview. A lot of grand juries at the outset of the pandemic were either closed or substantially limited, or suspended, I should say. And that has started to open up again. The grand juries have started to provide more time and open up more. So I think there's certainly been some real impact from the pandemic, but for the most part, our investigations are moving at pace. We're still initiating cases at the same pace that we have in years past, and certainly our resolutions, as I think you've seen, you know, over the past few months, we've resolved a number of cases, including Goldman Sachs, Beam, Herbalife, and Novartis, and Sargent Marine, for that matter, and J&F. So as I think through it, there really are a number of cases that we've resolved, corporate cases that we've resolved, and we've charged a number of individuals as well. So we're continuing to move on all fronts of our cases.
Yeah, and I want to come back to Jim Beam and Goldman Sachs in a moment. But first, you talked about the pandemic and the effects it's had. You know, the transformation in work, you know, it's just been enormous, with so many people now working from home, or even vacation cabins have now become permanent homes. That combined with travel restrictions are making things challenging, not just, you know, for you as a prosecutor, but for compliance teams as well. when it comes to everything from previously face-to-face training to conducting investigations. Now, does the DOJ recognize that, and how has it affected your expectations of compliance programs?
So we absolutely understand that. We are all living through this. These are obviously extremely challenging times. And so what we are looking to do is understand, just as we do with the compliance program generally, understand the choices that are being made. If the company is explaining the choices that it's making, and is also taking appropriate steps to address its risk, then of course we're going to understand if it may not be the typical way of doing so. But I think what we are not okay with is if a company abdicates its compliance responsibilities. From our perspective, the pandemic is certainly an excuse to maybe alter the way that a company may be doing things, but it's not an excuse to simply decide that we're just not going to devote resources to compliance or exercise our compliance responsibilities. So, by way of example, just because a company may not be able to as easily undertake in-person reviews or in-person interviews, that doesn't mean that a company can't undertake interviews, that it can't analyze data, that it can't do email reviews, and do a number of things irrespective of whether or not travel is allowed or in-person meetings are allowed. So I think there's a number of things that companies can do. By the same token, if a company is facing significant financial pressure and the company is making cuts across the board, we're certainly going to be understanding if that means that there may be cuts to compliance as well. But we're really going to want to understand what those cuts are and why they're made. Just because a company, for example, were to downsize doesn't mean that compliance would necessarily be downsized by the same proportion. As with every compliance program we're looking at, what we're looking at is whether the company is doing a risk assessment, analyzing its risk. And for example, if a company downsizes by 10%, that doesn't mean that its risk is necessarily downsizing by 10%. Its risk may even increase. And so what we really want to understand, as we always do, is how is a company looking at its risk? How is a company addressing its risk? And what compliance choices it's making as a result?
Yeah, I think it's very tempting for companies often to just say, let's do things across the board. But I think what you're saying there is a prudent point, is just because there's less people doesn't mean that there's necessarily less risk. And it also sounds as if, as companies go along, they should take the time to not just make a decision, but make sure that they document why they made that decision and what the reasons were. Now, looking through the recent settlements in the fraud section, are there any that compliance teams should take particular note of? I mean, I'm tempted to go right to the very large Goldman Sachs settlement that received a lot of attention just this week, in fact. What can compliance teams learn from it?
So I think there's a number of lessons across all of our recent resolutions, including Goldman. And it's something that, I've certainly said before publicly, and I think it's important for compliance programs to know, which is there is a commitment to compliance that is extremely important. You can set up a compliance program extremely well, and you can have all of the controls in place, and you can set up all the bells and whistles. But something that's important across the board with all of the companies that we see is making sure that compliance program is applied equally, regardless of the size of a deal, regardless of the importance of a deal, and certainly the culture of compliance is extremely important. And look, there are ways to measure that. There are ways to promote that. And we've certainly spoken about some of those ideas in the past, in both in terms of measurement and in ways of encouraging a culture of compliance. And I think that's one of the things that you see in the evaluation of corporate compliance programs as well. It used to be tone at the top, and we changed it to conduct at the top, And then we further changed it to conduct at upper and middle management, and the tone at upper and middle management, because really it's not just whether the CEO of a company is sending around an email or a video message saying that they believe strongly in compliance. Whether or not upper and middle management is devoted to compliance it permeates all the decisions that are being made. And even if someone sends a strong email, if there's a meeting where it's pretty obvious that compliance concerns are being overlooked because it's a very profitable deal, the employees are going to understand that, know that, and learn from that and act upon it. And so that is always, I think, a really important one, making sure that the compliance program is applied equally, that the culture is, you know, very clear that all levels of management believe in compliance and really walk the walk. And I think you saw that certainly in the most recent resolution that we announced, Beam, as well, where you had a member of the legal department really try to avoid learning of certain misconduct, and then on the back end, not the company not receiving full credit, in part because they failed to discipline all of the individuals who were involved in the misconduct. And so, you know, those are, I think, some important lessons to learn from our recent resolutions, and one that hopefully companies are drawing from them.
One of the things that's often discussed is the relationship between the compliance team and legal, and that there's a potential there that, you know, legal's job is to defend the company, compliance's job is to make sure the rules are followed, and there can be a conflict there. And it's ultimately for management to decide, because legal may say, look, we don't really need to look into this, or we shouldn't. If we don't know about it, it's less of a problem. And compliance will say, no, we have to own these things. Is there a lesson to be learned from the Beam case in terms of the need for compliance and legal to be separate?
So just generally speaking, we certainly look, and I think our guidance makes this clear as well. We're always looking to make sure that compliance is sufficiently independent and has a direct line to the board, even if it's a dotted line, to be able to report up. It is. There's no question that it's important that compliance is empowered and has the ability to make important decisions that undoubtedly will ultimately be considered as well with business decisions. But at the same time, you know, compliance, I think that companies that we've seen that are getting it right are ones that fully and appropriately empower compliance and give them the independence that they need. Now, we don't necessarily say that the mere fact that compliance and legal are not separated is per se a bad compliance program, but we certainly look at that issue and would look very closely if there is that interdependence and a lack of dependent independence for the compliance program.
Well, thank you for all of these insights. I really appreciate you sharing them with us, and also look forward to having you join us in 2021 at the SCCE Corporate Compliance Enforcement Conference. I also want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen today. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA. I hope we're able to expand your compliance perspective.